feel moved to share with you that I'm feeling a little nervous. So I often find being in this position and speaking sometimes a little bit challenging. And also just to say, for me, actually seeing you is really lovely at the same time. And that actually I'm feeling this group is a really supportive group. I don't know if others are experiencing this group that way, but for me, having the privilege of actually seeing you all from the front, it's really lovely actually. And I really want to thank you for your practice and the commitment that you have to coming here session by session, and really feeling the heartfulness and the sincerity of your journeys on this retreat through the small groups and that I've encountered. And I'm aware that it's often not easy. So really appreciate your practice. Also really happy to hear that for some of you at some times it's also fruitful and nourishing. Those of you, most of you here, would have seen me bowing to these two, well, to this area of the hall, and I just thought I'd explain that a little bit. Because as Jake said, that this retreat brings together the two worlds of secular mindfulness-based support, stress reduction and cognitive therapy from quite appropriately very secular settings offered in a secular way, and the wisdoms and teachings and practices have origins in tradition, the Buddhist tradition, or traditions you could say, as there are so many different strands that have emerged from that one historical figure. In some aspects of the Buddhist teaching, it is very sort of psychological, which makes a lot of sense, I think, to us these days. And it's also coming from a perspective which is couched within religious views and practice. And many of those religious views and practices are part of the path of cultivation and of support for people, and including me. And that's why I bow to these statues, because for me, it's a support. And it reminds me of the depth of the tradition. And there was a note asking about the two statues, so I will just give my own understanding. So the figure on the right is a depiction of Buddha, or Sakya, I've forgotten, Siddhartha, that's it. Siddhartha, who became the Buddha, as we understand it through the records. And it's a depiction of sort of just after his awakening. The story is that he, after many years, achieved this understanding of the origin of suffering and the end of suffering. And yet, beautifully human as he was in the story, he was assailed by doubt in the form of this figure, Mara. It's like, who are you to have this understanding? And his reply was really beautiful. He touched the earth. And this is this posture of the Buddha touching the earth, saying, the earth is my witness to my understanding. And at that, Mara disappeared. And one interpretation of this is that this statue represents wisdom and insight. And that mudra, as it's called, that gesture of the hand of touching the earth, is actually shows the power of the ground, which we've been talking about quite a lot on this retreat, as almost a way to support a sense of reality beyond, if we think of it perhaps in a more modern psychological way, his pattern of doubt in the figure of Mara, was like, no, I know that I have understood and the world is my witness. So touching the ground has a deep history in this tradition. And then the figure here behind me, you may not be able to see so well, is a more feminine figure. She has a name, Kuan Yin, from the Chinese tradition. And she's an embodiment or an archetype of compassion. So the quality of heart and wisdom that sees and hears suffering and difficulty and feels it and responds in a spacious, in a balanced, wise way. So she's the embodiment of compassion. So we have wisdom and compassion here. So in this talk, I was feeling quite unsure, as Jake knows very well, what I was going to talk about tonight. What came to me over these days and particularly today, were just some reflections on some aspects of the mindfulness tradition as is taught in the 8-week courses and as is present in my understanding of this Buddhist tradition, this insight meditation Buddhist tradition. So these are my reflections and understandings at this point, and please feel free to take what's useful and leave the rest. It's probably going to be a bit of an overview of some core themes in the courses and in the teachings. And so there may be quite a lot of detail, and really don't feel you need to remember it all. Sort of my attempt, in a way, perhaps to explain to myself something of why this practice might be valuable. So my starting point was considering a phrase that is probably very familiar to teachers and people who've participated in 8-week courses, which is the being mind and the doing mind. I suspect that might be familiar to some here. And particularly the formulation of the doing mind, known as I think it was the Oxford Centre, some teaching there, suggested seeing it as the driven doing mind. So the driven doing mind, it has these particular kind of qualities. This is not an exhaustive list, but see if this resonates for you as I speak it. When we're caught in driven doing mind, we tend to be caught by automatic habits of thoughts, behaviours, feelings. It's feeling like we're being driven by something. There's a compulsive quality to this state of mind. It's hard to let it go, whatever it is. Usually a push or a pull, that thought, I just have to think about it. It's really hard not to. Almost like something important depends on me doing this right now. If I don't do it, something unpleasant will happen, and I can't even think about what that is. I just have to do it. In the driven doing mind, generally it's quite a narrow mind. It becomes very focused, and Jake's already referred a bit to this already, as the gap between what we perceive we have or where we are, what we are, and what we want. And that gap can easily widen very quickly in moments even, between perhaps what I don't want right now and what I do want over there. Because that could be on a micro level or a bigger level, as dissatisfactions sometimes kind of take on a life of their own. And even on just quite subtle level of just reaching for things automatically without thinking about it. This isn't wrong, but this is just part of our human conditioning, and sometimes it's very appropriate. The driven doing mind that keeps us safe from danger, for example, jumps out of the way of a car. But in this driven doing mind, often, particularly when it's in our heads, we lose contact with the body. And I really liked and found valuable the phrase Jake used earlier of entering the virtual world. It really made sense to me. If this world gets created in my head, that is my reality at that time of he said this, she said that, oh no, that means that I've got to do that, or should I do that, and oh, what do they think about me, and this whole thing is there and has this sort of almost like a, you know, a drama, like a EastEnders or a film or something. It's got this, oh, the drama of the virtual world. So I'm kind of outlining what I'm hoping you recognise, and because it's likely that we've all arrived with quite a strong driven doing patterning showing up quite a lot, just getting here, you know, that there will have needed to be quite a lot of effort, and within that probably a lot of reactivity as well, and then the settling into the retreat, the reactivity that comes with that. And retreats are very good at showing up, you know, the driven doing mind, on sometimes with just really small things like, I can't stand here in the queue any longer. Or, what's another one? I just have to have a chocolate now. Or, if only it was sunny. Yeah, or, if only it wasn't so hot. Or, you know, these sorts of things actually can become really intense when there's not a lot else for the mind to circle around. I guess the pain in the body, very, very understandable and common one. You know, and how the mind, we might speak more about this as the week goes on, but how the mind will easily build on a small pain. So it becomes, if I don't move in this next moment, I'll never walk again. I mean, I may be exaggerating, but it like goes a bit in that direction. It can do for me. It's like, I've been here before. It'll be okay. But this time's different. No, it's fine. Just give it a moment. You can move, but just pause a little moment. So the being mind, this contrast of the being mind, you know, which on these 8-week courses we do spend, you know, a lot of time contrasting these modes, and particularly maybe your main emphasis really of the 8-week courses is helping participants have a taste of what the being mind can be like. Which perhaps is another word really for kind of experiencing mindfulness. And what's it like to directly taste a moment or a few moments of mindful awareness without being driven by something else? So the being mind, I came up with, it's spacious. We can consider many options and we don't feel compelled to just choose one. We've got some ability to access our wisdom, you know, that we've have from our lives to make a wise choice. It's receptive, so it's able to receive experience. So it's able to be aware of more because it's less narrow, non-judgmental. I realise I'm probably saying things that many of you know very well. That sense of, yeah, it's quite that's sort of more, in a way, a little bit more passive, receptive, whatever here, whatever comes, whatever's unfolding, oh, it can be of equal interest. And mindfulness can be there, as I was saying on the first day, like a good friend, there for it all. You know, it doesn't discriminate, or she doesn't discriminate. Oh, I only really want to be with you for that experience, but not that one. It's like, oh, okay, so it's like this. And as opposed to the driven doing mind, where we tend to lose contact with the body, it's really facilitated through contact with the senses. So we're in touch with our direct senses, our sight, our smell, our hearing, our sensations within the body, potentially our thoughts as well, if they're not kind of taking us on a ride. So it's inherently connected with the body through the senses and experienced through the senses. And of course, friendliness, acceptance, allowing, very much part of the being mind. So one of the reasons I was thinking about driven doing and being mind was because I was also reflecting on how I really value the doing mind, and there is a real importance to doing in meditation, in this path, in this tradition. But it has a different quality when it's perhaps helpful, what in the so Buddhist tradition might call onward leading, leading towards a taste of, people sometimes talk about the one taste of freedom. The practice, and I know that you will, I'm sure, have been experiencing this, whether consciously or not, requires a lot of actual effort and doing. So I was thinking, what's different between the driven doing and the doing that is needed and actually helpful? So I thought I'd call it skillful doing. And another word I thought was maybe being doing. Actually, the distinction between being and doing starts to break down a little bit. Although they are slightly different, they're very interlinked and support each other. So, for example, in the being mind, we are more available to hear our wisdom and compassion, and we are more able to sense what might be really helpful here. What do I really need? And it might well be that that has brought you here to Gaia House and all that effort that you made to come here. And it's that which we are, which can help guide us in our practice on the cushion. We need to be able to receptively sense our experience, to know how to respond, how to help ourselves, how to make the little decisions in practice we need to make. I'm making an assumption here that it's helpful to make decisions. Because I guess there are different styles of practice. There is a style of practice which is, I just need to get to the cushion and then that's it. I'm just going to sit here and see what happens. And there's a real value in that kind of practice. And it can be really helpful to do that at times, even if it's not the main style of practice. But I also feel that there's really a helpful role for a skillful doing that has a sort of purpose behind it, a purpose and a wisdom. In a way, you know, why are we doing what we're doing? What's it in service of? And in any particular practice period, you know, what are we aiming to do? What are we training in? As Jon Kabat-Zinn said, we're always training in something, whether we like it or not. And I have to admit, and I'm sure I'm not on my own here, that quite a lot of my practices can be get to the cushion and I do a really good training in mind wandering, you know, I can get really good at it. You're very practiced. Yeah. So this territory, I think, of skillful doing in practice and how this being or this mindfulness mode of mind and heart and body, the being mind, can support us in skillful doing and how they weave together, it is linked with effort that Jake mentioned before. Because driven doing can come into our practice. Have you noticed that? We come with a lovely, spacious intention. Oh, this is going to be really helpful. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to follow my breath. Oh, I really need to follow my breath. I'm really going to follow my breath now. Oh, no, I've missed a breath. I'm going to come back to the breath. And in a way, somehow, a little bit of driven doing has started to creep in into that effort. And that's when effort can start to become a bit tight. So although it may not be an obvious reaction to a trigger, you know, something unpleasant, and but actually it's in a way it's a little bit more of a subtle reaction to something that is not quite right that we're detecting in our practice. It hasn't met our expectations in some way, or it's not quite going as what I mean it's not quite going as it should. You know, we have some view of how it should be, consciously or unconsciously, or yeah, a view of ourselves of I really want to get here, or if I'm this kind of practitioner, I should be like this. I've been practicing for so many years. I'm now sitting at the front. Surely now I should be able to keep still. I'm going to really work hard to keep still. And it's like, you know, there can be a value in that, of course, but what I find is when I get into a bit of angst in my practice, for whatever reason, when I realise that, and if I remember, a really helpful antidote to readjust my stringed instrument of effort is to come to kindness, to remember, okay, something's out of balance here. What's needed? And really asking that question, I've really discovered using this a lot, actually, that it's not necessarily my view of what kindness should look like. It's more important how I ask the question. It's like, if I can ask that question with as much kindness as I can muster in that moment, in a really open way, because I think, well, certainly my experience has been to open to a kindly response, I have to come out of whatever habit of mind I'm in that moment that thinks it should be like this and I'm like that. So I need to be able to ask that question without knowing what the answer is going to be. So it's like I just heartfully ask the question, what do I need right now? And often then coming into my body, the ground, perhaps. And it's like I need to have contact with something a bit bigger than my idea of self in that moment, so that a little bit of wisdom and compassion can kind of come around the corner and meet me. Like, oh yeah, it's okay. It's all right if I have that thought. Or, okay, there's tension building up because I feel I should be a certain way in my body. Maybe if I just relax into this posture a bit more, it will be easier to be with. And then it's really okay. I can move or not move. The pressure's off. It's like, take the pressure off. That's automatically a lot easier. So I'm just going to take a pause. Because my driven doing mind can start to think about all these things that I'd like to say, and what's the time? And perception of time has a very interesting effect on the driven doing mind. It can increase it. So if you find this, like, 15 minutes left, all this, oh, should I do that? It's like, maybe I need to get through it all. if I don't, will that be okay? But maybe it'll be too much. It's like, I think I'm going to pause. Softening the body, feeling my feet on the ground, letting myself take a deep breath. Asking the question, what's needed? What would be helpful? Beyond my ideas of right and wrong. Yeah, so I think my question is actually, what energy for more information and exploration, and when will it become too much? And I don't know, actually. I don't know. So what I was thinking of offering was some sort of reflections, taking this little bit into the territory of kind of ways being and doing mindfulness and skillful intention and action in meditation, what different ways they can come together, and that we have been using them on this retreat to give you kind of more flavors of how skillful doing can kind of show up. So just one very brief one that I've found really helpful in my meditative journey is from the Buddhist tradition, and there are these two words that are from the Pali early Indian language called vitakka and vichara. So vitakka, that first word, that is referring to, well, actually there are different ways of interpreting it, but the way I interpret it and find helpful is to think of it as, where do we place our attention? What choice do we make about where we place our attention? One teacher, Catherine, who teaches here, she's been referring to vitakka recently as, what's the agreement I make with myself in this practice? So, for example, if the style of practice where I would sit on a cushion and just see what happens, actually I have formed an intention, and my vitakka, if you like, is to sit on the cushion and perhaps a spacious awareness. So, but it could be something more focused. It could be, my anchor, this is another word for vitakka, is where I'm going to place my attention is going to be, for this practice, the whole body here, including the contact with the floor. So vitakka is communicating to oneself, what's the intention for this practice? What anchor do I want to use? So when my automatic, however it strong or weak it is, driven doing mind takes me off somewhere, actually, where do I consciously want to train myself to grow my abilities to be present? So I could say coming back, and it could be actually more positively, rather than letting go of the driven doing mind, what do I actually really want to grow? Christina Feltman, I first heard it from her. I don't know if she originated this phrase, but I really like it. She said once, what we pay attention to grows. You may well have heard this in training. And it's true. It's like, where we place our attention, generally over time, sometimes even in the moment, it becomes more of our world, if you like. Which is why it can be really beautiful to develop anchors that are useful and interesting, because they become more part of our world. You're really getting to know our breath and all kinds of ways our breath can move in and out of the body. Or getting to know our body in a more general way, or different aspects of the body. So, as I think I've hopefully communicated, vitakka, it has this intentional quality. So it's a skillful doing. It's more active. And even the sound of the word vitakka, I quite like the Pali, because it sounds more energetic. Vitakka, here. It's a little bit like attack, which is a bit unfortunate. So I would not see it in that way. I'm going to attack my breath. But vitakka, or here, it's like a clarity. Here is my intention. And that clarity can really help me when the mind's off. It's like, no, it was here that I wanted to be, and this is where I'm going to re-engage. Vichara, the other word, has a different sound, which is softer to my ear. Vichara. So maybe you can already get a sense of it's not so, but more ah, vichara. And as I understand it, and again, there are different interpretations and ways of using this concept, but I use it to mean a more receptive quality that receives experience. So vitakka and vichara work together, and it can be a little bit like the doing mind and the being mind in perfect harmony. A bit cheesy, but so vitakka, let's say I come to my belly and the breath in my belly, receiving the experience of the breath in my belly, and it may be that's the practice, that is it. Vitakka, remembering, yes, the breath in my belly. What's that like? Lovely. But it could be that I think, okay, my practice intention is also to explore this a little bit more. So then it would be, for example, a possibility would be, breath in my belly. That's a particular kind of breath. It's like a full, spacious, balloony sort of breath. And what else is there? You know, what's it like at the end of the breath? So then the vitakka quality is coming in with a question. It's like directing the mind to examine it a bit more closely. So then what else is there? Always a little bit of tension in my back. What happens when I notice that? Another question. Even just the noticing of that, it's starting to change as I notice it. That's interesting. So that could be a little bit sometimes a dialogue. We can take a dialogue into practice between vitakka and vichara as it is opening up, you know, that theme of practice together with vichara. So almost like vitakka is asking the question, but vichara is giving some lovely information for them, vitakka. There is a school which would say it's a bit different, and that vichara itself has an evaluative quality, and that the way we kind of contemplate something, that is vichara. And in a way, they do start to kind of mould a bit together, vitakka, vichara, which is which. And in a way, it doesn't really matter. As long as there's a sense, I feel, of intention, of receptivity, and perhaps a sense of, you know, where am I going with this, or why am I doing it, and what's interesting me here. And then a kind of spacious exploration. And we know when it gets out of balance, and perhaps we lose the vichara because it starts to become tight in some way or frustrating. I've lost my balance with my stringed instrument of effort. Let me just lean back more into receptivity and maybe actually more like, what's here? What's here? But if we get really sleepy or just dull, then maybe a bit more of a vitaka of, oh, I'm really going to bring my attention here and, oh, actually, what's happening? Asking more questions, getting more interested, inviting interest. So tempting, so tempting. How much more to do? Another area of skillful doing I was reflecting on, which is vitakkha and vichara would be in service of, is skillful cultivation. So this is when we're really clear that we are actually aiming to grow something in our practice. So we've been doing this on this retreat. In day one, we were aiming to encourage, as teachers were encouraging us all to grow our capacity for some steadiness and some calmness. So there was a clear intention for that day, and the instructions we were offering were in service of cultivating that quality. So, particularly the ground, particularly the more soothing or pleasant aspects of experience, we were inviting you to particularly pay attention to that in the service of settling, calming and gathering. So a skillful doing, I would say. And then the befriending practices after lunch, they're a really explicit cultivation of a certain range of qualities of the heart under the heading of befriending and metta in different ways, but with a clear aim of just very gently nurturing those qualities that are already there, but what we give attention to grows. So we are giving attention to it in those practice periods. And of course, other things will come up often. And in metta practice, it's a really good example for many of us that when there's a certain intention to cultivate a quality, that it will trigger some reactivity. Another opportunity to work with reactivity, and that kind of driven doing kind of impulse that might be there. But in this case, we, with the tools of metta and befriending, leaning into that quality. So a skillful doing of growing something that's really helpful, hopefully, that's the intention. And then there's another kind of skillful doing, which we also do very much in this work of 8-week course practice and on these retreats, which could be seen as a skillful undoing. So it's a doing that is, rather than growing, it's kind of looking at experience in a way that in some ways can deconstruct it. It sounds a bit intellectual and postmodern when I say deconstruct, to me anyway. But what I mean is, and for those who've practiced in 8-week courses, hopefully will recognize this, is there's a pattern of reactivity. Maybe it's, let's say, anxiety. And it's this experience that has all kinds of unpleasantness to it, and it might be felt in different ways as a kind of a blob or an agitation, a whirlwind, a rippling on the waters of my mind, whipped by wind, It's like, ugh, generally, well, I don't like it, wish it would go away. So in the 8-week course, you know, the tools that we use, actually, what's going on there? There are thoughts, there are feelings, there are body sensations. And with the support of mindfulness, I'm going to give her a gender, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to say herself, because mindfulness in the Pali word sati, one scholar says is feminine. And for me, I like that, mindfulness, this feminine quality that's there, good friend, always there. But you don't feel you need to use a female gender yourself. But with the support of mindfulness herself, looking at these different elements, it's like somehow the world that anxiety has created of catastrophizing the future of disaster, actually it starts to deflate a little bit. You know, it's kind of deconstructed into more elements that are less building up of this virtual reality and a kind of simpler realities. Like we're kind of deconstructing, or one teacher says defabricating. It's another kind of skillful doing, and one that we're going to be exploring more as we go on through this retreat. And these are different aspects of our body, heart, and mind that I would say are really useful to cultivate. So there's that growing the really helpful capacities of heart and mind, such as calmness and kindness, befriending, other heart qualities, appreciation, compassion. And also, other cultivations we've been touching into today, just to name them, seeing the body as elements. We haven't gone into this, but we've named it. But it's actually a cultivation of earth, body is earth, which is in contact with the greater earth. You know, where's the difference? We're all earth. Actually, it's a really skillful cultivation of a certain kind of experience of body. The body as its anatomy, we did a little bit in the movement practice as well as in Jake's practice, is a kind of way of being in the body that's a skillful cultivation of awareness. All the contemplations around death and mortality that were mentioned. Or body as tree. So these are all cultivations, I'm trying to say. We're kind of building or growing, constructing a really helpful image and state. And then this other kind of skillful doing, which is more deconstructing, examining. And actually, as we do that, it can usually bring peace, love, possibility. It's not that this kind of deconstructing is kind of neutral in a way. It generally has a releasing and helpful quality. And it may be that you've noticed this even so far on retreat when, for example, you may have been working with some bodily pain and you've investigated it and, it's eased, you know. And then what comes with that ease? Is it just a neutral experience, or is it actually pleasant, or is there any heartfulness there? Maybe something to explore for yourself. So kind of overall, sort of my aim really with these reflections and why I wanted to explore them through this talk is there are so many possibilities of practice, and that this body, this head part of my body and the mind that is this virtual reality machine in here, this heart, all of you, perhaps everything is more than we think. There are more possibilities here to discover through practice, if we want to, with the help of vitakka and vichara and these different skills that we're developing. So I'd just like to finish with a quote from one of the early suttas, which is a quote as recorded as best we know, possibly the words of the Buddha or the remembered words of the Buddha by those that wrote them down. It is just within this fathom-long body, with its perception and intellect, that I declare that there is the cosmos, the origination of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of the cosmos. It is just within this fathom-long body, with its perception and intellect, that I declare that there is the cosmos, the origination of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of the cosmos. So perhaps we could just take a pause to finish.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.